It's the JT the Brick Show, broadcasting live from the Finley Cadillac Performance Studio.
Raiders bring a blitz. He takes up off the middle, and he's wrapped up from behind. Max Crosby!
Your silver and black home to sound off for over 25 years.
Open at the 35, racing to the 20, 10, touchdown Raiders!
And now, here's JT the Brick.
Michael Mayer was the guy that was drafted here with high accolades. You were in the college game and he was doing everything in college. And feels like there's a lot left on the bone there with Michael Mayer. How does he kind of find his way?
How old is he? A lot left on the bone. I mean, he's 23?
No doubt about it.
God, remember when we were 23?
Yeah, right. Unfortunately.
But he had a rough upbringing then.
Yeah. Brock Bowers.
Am I right?
It was too good.
Yeah.
It was too good. But Brock Bowers, you know, he comes in and sort of takes some of the luster away. Mm-hmm. How do you kind of figure out a way to get the most out of Michael Mayer?
I think Mike has been outstanding since I've been here. And for all of us, we came in kind of tabula rasa. We're a blank slate. Like, we watch film of all the players just to kind of get an understanding of what they did. But we didn't make any decisions on anything until you see him here. And Mike's been fantastic since day one of the offseason program when we started early in April there, and what he did just in the weight room, what he's done in the meeting room, and then what we did in phase two, and then what he's continued to do here. So really, really excited about him. And there's never a position anywhere where a coach will say, you know what, we have too many good players. Like, that's never the case, especially in this league, because everybody's really talented that you're going to go against. So the more tight ends we can get, the more wideouts we can get, the more running backs we can get, the more quarterbacks you can get, then we'll continue to take them. But I think Mike's been outstanding. And I check, you can play with two tight ends in a game at the same time. And sometimes you can play with three tight ends, they told me. So maybe we can get to that if we have to. Obviously, you're going to try to attack each team you're playing each week differently, depending on how they defend you. But, you know, to be able to have that ability and have a couple quality guys, because Ian Thomas has been outstanding, and he's a guy that's played a lot of snaps in this league too. So
that's Chip Kelly talking about Michael Mayer. And by the way, every time I hear that sound bite, I'm blown away that he actually used the term tabula rasa. You want to know what tabula rasa is? It's a Latin term literally for blank slate. He ended up following up, probably looking at us, all us idiots that were in front of him going, yeah, they're not going to know what tabula rasa means. It means blank slate. And so what was he referring to? He was referring to how the coaching staff approached this job, this first season with the Raiders, with the holdover players that are still on this roster from last year and the year before, et cetera, et cetera. With a blank slate. And that was really interesting because I remember talking to Brandon Carroll, the Raiders' new offensive line coach. If the name rings a bell, yes, he is the son of Pete Carroll, the new offensive line coach, formerly the offensive coordinator at Washington, and before that, the University of Arizona with Jed Fish, coached at Arizona and at Washington with Jed. Did really well, too, by the way. Go look at the numbers at Arizona with Brendan Carroll. There were some pretty prolific numbers that they put up there in Tucson, and then again at Washington in their year together there. Anyway, what Brendan Carroll said was kind of reiterated what Chip said, which was looked a little bit at the film last year of these current players, but kind of purposely didn't do a whole lot of that because they wanted that blank slate, that tabula rasa, as Chip Kelly referred to it as, in terms of being able to, so that really the first observation that you have of these players is through your own eyes and not through a lens that has to filter the fact that, well, Michael Mayer was playing in Josh McDaniels' offense. You know, then he was playing in Luke Getsy's offense, or this player was playing in that scheme or that blocking coverage, and which can sometimes taint your view of a player. So rather than, you know, have your view altered because it's being filtered through so many different filters and offenses that they were playing against playing in schemes, what they were being asked to do. And really, when you're watching on film, I don't care how good of a coach you are or how observant you are of football, you still don't know exactly what the call was. You don't know what the player was being asked to do on that particular play. So you know, we could all sit here and say, wow, the tackle blew the block. And the tackle will tell you, you know, a week later when you're talking to me about it, yeah, I didn't actually. The coverage that we called, the blocking scheme that we called at the line of scrimmage was for me not to block that guy. That guy was the free guy. The quarterback should have known that, you know, and accounted for or that or you know, slid the protection so that we did block that guy. So what you sometimes see on film, you can make a rash judgment about only to find out that you were completely wrong. You're absolutely wrong because you didn't know what the exact responsibility was. So for that reason, you know, when Chip Kelly talks about everybody having a blank slate now with this current coaching staff and really trying not to pay too much attention to what they put on film the last year in particular, because it could alter your view of that player. So better to just, hey, I'm going to start assessing you and judging you and relating to you and painting a picture of you through my own lens, my own two eyes, based on my interactions with you, what you're doing with what I'm asking you to do, how you fit in my scheme, how you fit in what we're asking you to do. And I think that's a healthy way of approaching something, because we all have preconceived ideas, right? And I've learned so many times, you guys, so many times in my career, not to do that, and to approach everybody that comes into my circle, whether it's professionally or personally, once they are literally in my circle or I'm in their circle, face to face, with my own two eyes and my own two ears, and hearing them and getting to know that person, again, whether it's professionally or personally. And one of the man, what an eye-opener this one was. There's two that really jump to mind for me. One was Ron Artest. Okay, so you go back a few years ago, I'm covering the Lakers at the time, and they trade for Ron Artest. At the time, it would have been impossible for anyone that was either covering the NBA, a fan of the NBA, not to have some kind of preconceived idea of Ron Artest. You know, he was a guy that forced his, you know, we saw what happened in Indiana, you know, with the melee in Detroit, the melee in Detroit. He goes to the Sacramento Kings. There was a lot of drama, it felt like, with Ron Artest, and it was easy to sit there from afar and cast a judgment on Ron Artest, right? And he was peculiar. He was this. He was that. He was a little off the wall. He was, you know, whatever preconceived idea you might have had from him based on what was happening 3,000 miles away, you know, you're gonna form an opinion, right? And so I kind of did, I guess. But I've always preached this and tried to act accordingly on this. No matter what I think of somebody, based on what I think I saw or I think I heard or what I heard or whatever the case might be, it's always going to be a clean slate for me once you get into my world and I'm in your world, right? And so Ron Artest comes to the Lakers. I couldn't be more blown away about how different he was compared to what I thought he was. And it was another reminder of it's not healthy to have these preconceptions of somebody and then judge them only based on that and never adjust to how different they may actually be in person and when you're dealing with them. So Ron Artest was one, turned out to be one of the more enjoyable guys that I ever covered throughout my career. I had so many conversations with him. He and Lamar Odom used to sit next to each other in the locker room over at Staples Center. And they were one of the few guys at that time who would actually come out and sit and talk to the media before games. So there was a lot of interaction. We would all kind of huddle around them. And these are two guys from Queens, New York, that had story after story after story and were so smart in their own way. And it was just fabulous and fantastic getting to know both of those players. And so whatever preconceived idea I had about Ron Artest completely changed based on my interactions with Ron Artest. The other guy, more recently, was Richie Incognito. We all know what Richie Incognito's history was, some of the drama, some of the controversies, and all that sort of thing. You know, try as you might, you probably had an idea, right, of who Richie Incognito was based on what you read, what you saw. Some of the things that, as in retrospect, as the years have gone on, turned out to be completely false. Completely misinterpreted, misreported, in terms of making accusations. It was all a bunch of BS, whatever. So hopefully as the years go on, you know, Richie Incognito's name is going to get cleared more and more and more as the year goes on. We all know what I'm talking about. But again, there were things that had happened in his past, and it sort of slanted how people viewed him, including myself. But preaching what I always try to adhere to, which was whatever it was, I'm certainly not gonna hold that against him. I'm just gonna assess him or accept him or whatever based on my interactions with him. So kind of a clean slate. And I could not have been more blown away by who Richie Incognito was in that setting compared to viewing him and assessing him from 3,000 miles away. So it's always an important reminder. But we fast forward to now and to Chip Kelly talking about somebody like a Michael Mayer and not getting caught up in what did happen or didn't happen for him his first 2 years in the NFL. And that goes for every player that's returning from last year's team. And, you know, with this new coaching staff, as Brendan Carroll said, try not to look at what happened last year on film, because I wasn't here. I don't know what the calls were. I don't know what they were being asked to do. All I can do is judge them in terms, looking at them through my lens and what I'm asking them to do. And I think that's a healthy attitude to have. Circling back to Michael Mayer, based on what we saw in minicamp and OTAs, it sure feels like this could be the year that he breaks out. Now, we have to put it all into context and all in perspective. He's not going to be the tight end one with the Raiders. That job is being occupied by a guy by the name of Brock Bowers, and rightfully so. This is one of the most dynamic young players to come into the league in a long time, and certainly the most dynamic tight end to come into the league in quite some time. And I still feel like he's just scratching the surface. A young kid, you know, what is he, 22 years old, all of 22 years old, lit the world last year as a rookie. Expect even more things from Brock Bowers. And more impact. And I know for him, you know, talking to him time and time and time again after a fabulous game personally, and just the disappointment in his voice and his demeanor, having to talk about himself and all these great things that he was doing individually in light of a loss, it drove him nuts. He hated it. Honestly, he hated it. And he couldn't separate the two. You want me to talk about myself and all these things that I'm doing and my team just lost? It was completely foreign to him based on what he had done at college. What did he lose? 2 games in college, won 2 national championships in college, maybe 3 games that he lost in college, played at the highest level, played at the Super Bowl of college football twice, back-to-back championships. And then it comes to the Raiders, and unfortunately, because of circumstance, it's loss after loss after loss after loss. So Brock Bowers, it'll be fun to cover a player that's that good, that's doing great things in games that mean something, in wins. I fully expect that to be the case. And to me, that's when the greatest memories are forged and made. When 20 years down the line, Raider fans, contemporary Raider fans, remember a Brock Bowers, and hopefully for the Raiders, for the fans, and for Brock Bowers, as time goes on, he's going to be doing those things, those same things that he did last year, and continuing to do that only in games that really matter and that mean something and scores a game-winning touchdown or helps pull the Raiders even in a big critical moment or scores, you know, puts the Raiders up by 14 with 2 minutes left to ice the game, comes up with a big first down catch on a must-have drive on a fourth down thing, and it led to a win. That's where memories are really forged. But Brock Bowers is the decided number one tight end, so that's the reality that Michael Mayer is dealing with. But is there a way for Chip Kelly and this Raiders offensive staff to figure out a way that Michael Mayer can have an impact, can make an impact? The numbers are going to be skewed toward Brock Bowers, right? More so. And that's just the fact of the matter. He's that good. You want to get him the ball as many times as you possibly can because he's dynamic with the ball. But Michael Mayer is no slouch either. And how do the Raiders kind of figure that out in terms of making sure that they don't, that Michael Mayer doesn't fall by the wayside again as he has these last 2 years, and that he's misused and not accessed the way he should be accessed? Because this is a guy, you go and watch the tape of him at Notre Dame, When the ball was in his hands, he's somebody else that made things happen. Was sure-handed, was a truck with the ball in his hands, could leap over you, could run through you, all of those things. We've yet to see that on a consistent basis in the NFL, but it's there for him. As Chip Kelly said, he's all of 23 years old. He's just completed his second season. Let's look at him from Chip Kelly's perspective through his lens and in his scheme and in his offense, and try to get the most out of him based on all that. So it will be interesting. I want your thoughts, 702-365-9200. Who is your number three option for the Raiders this year? Who do you think that's going to be? Is it going to be Jack Besh? Is it going to be Michael Mayer? Is it going to be Trey Tucker? Is it going to be Dante Thornton? It's exciting times, I think, because I think there's talent there, and it's obviously on Chip Kelly to make it all work, but it's also on the players themselves to make compelling enough cases for themselves to be that guy. Does Jack Besh say, hey, look, I'm going to be that guy. I'm going to be that reliable possession wide receiver that can make things happen when the ball is in my hands, that's going to out-physical people. You're not going to take me off the field because I mean too much to the run game in the block game. I'm going to be somebody that Geno Smith can rely on and lean on. I'm going to be available. I'm going to make things happen. I'm not going to make mistakes. I'm going to know the playbook. I'm going to know what I'm supposed to do. You're not going to need to take me off the field in any situation. I'm that guy. Does Jack Besh make that compelling of a case for himself to be on the field more often than not? Where's Dante Thornton in terms of his development as a wide receiver? He played at Tennessee. Not to talk bad about Tennessee, but they've got it's one of the more peculiar offenses that you're ever going to come across. They basically know exactly who they're going to throw to on every play. It's all based on, you know, matchups and the coach, you know, kind of can, you know how like in college baseball now, maybe it happens in Major League Baseball. I hope not, but it used to be that wherever you are, whatever level of baseball you're playing at, especially college and beyond, the catcher called the pitch in conjunction with the pitcher. He'd put the fingers down. Now it's whispering in the pitcher's ear, so that you mitigate the stealing signs. But basically, it was the catcher and the pitcher working in conjunction with each other. Now, go watch a college game. Watch the watch the catcher look over to the dugout so that the manager or the pitching coach can determine what the pitch is. He relays that to the catcher relays that to the pitcher, and that's the pitch that gets thrown. Well, that's kind of like how it is in some ways at Tennessee, because they predetermine where the ball is going to go before the play even starts. And what ultimately happens is you're asking your wide receivers to do less. You're obviously asking your quarterback to do less. You throw it to him, or you run, or you throw it away. That's kind of how it goes. And so Dante Thornton, as a result of the offense that he was playing in, I think everybody understands there's a learning curve for him to master the finer points of playing wide receiver as a well-rounded wide receiver, as opposed to the kind of wide receiver he was asked to play or be at the University of Tennessee. So there is a learning curve. We all know that. We all understand that. But I'll say this about Dante Thornton. He looked a lot more polished in OTAs and minicamp than I thought he would. And I think that's the general consensus. Even Jacoby Myers at the top of the show talking about he's not just some guy that's going to be out on the field because of his speed and can run go routes all the time. He's somebody that could do more than just that. And you know, look, could the Raiders have caught a major break because the perception of Dante Thornton was a guy that was going to need a lot of time, you know, to hone his game and to work on his game, and as a result was there in the fourth round? I mean, maybe had he played, if he had stayed at Oregon, or if he played in an offense that was more, you know, conducive to what the NFL is asking wide receivers to do, and there would have been more work as a result, you know, maybe he's a second round pick. Maybe he's a third. Maybe he's not there in the fourth round is my whole point. Did the Raiders catch a break because of the offense that he played at and because of the perception that there might have been about Dante Thornton? Go read every scouting report about him. It mentions it all the time. It's a guy that's going to need some time. He needs some development time. I mean, everybody does. There's no question about that, going from the college game to the program. But sometimes there's less for some guys than there are than there is for others. Why? Well, some guys just played at a more you know player friendly or NFL friendly offense. So the transition to the NFL is not going to be as drastic as it is for some players. But whatever the case was, what Dante was doing at Tennessee, it sure looked like since that time, or maybe during that time, and we just didn't see it out on the field because he wasn't being asked to do anything, he was not wasting his time. He was developing all the other parts of his wide receiver game, even though we didn't get a chance to necessarily see it at Tennessee. That doesn't mean that he wasn't putting the work in during practice and during the week and during the off seasons, because he looked a lot more polished than we thought he was. Now, I got to say this, because, you know, we were there and we were reporting on it, and Dante was getting first team reps, albeit it felt more situational based on the down and distance and, you know, the red zone. He got a lot of work with the first team in the red zone. It feels like, you know, I'll go onto Facebook and I see some of these memes about Dante Thornton being so much further advanced and dominating practices and doing this and that. And I was like, it's interesting to me that some of the reports that we put out there, the reporters that were there at practice, what was read into that? Now, as I sit here today, and I think Q Myers, who will be coming up next 2 to 5 on Unsportsmanlike Conduct, he'll agree. He was more polished, and he did some nice things, Dante Thornton did, during OTAs. But we're not going to sit here and say that he dominated any practices. This wasn't a Randy Moss situation. You go back and read the reports in minicamp and into training camp on Randy Moss with the Minnesota Vikings. He was killing people, like literally. And it was a really good Minnesota Vikings team that he went to. Remember, he fell in the draft. Chris Carter was on that team. There was a really good defense. You know, that rookie year, they made the playoffs. I think they made the NFC Championship game that year. That was a prolific football team. And every report, and I've seen this before. I've definitely seen this before with players in the past. I saw it, put it this way. Aaron Donald dominated practice. Max Crosby dominates practice. All right? I don't have to go any further than Max Crosby. We sit there watching practice, whether it's in mini camp or OTAs or training camp, and Max Crosby is dominating every single day, dominating practices. And you just see it with the greats. That in Minnesota, they saw it with Randy Moss. I saw it with Aaron Donald covering the Rams. I certainly have seen it with Max Crosby covering, you know, the Raiders. Saw it a couple of years ago with Devontae Adams. Remember his first training camp with the Raiders when Derek was still the quarterback? There were days in practice where you're going, holy cow, this guy is a ball player. We all know how it kind of worked out for Dante or Devontae here. It wasn't any fault of his own. But there were days in practice where he was dominating practice. There's people who will tell you, I've talked to them, enough of them, that Brock Bowers during practices last year when it was closed off to us, when they were putting their game plan in, was dominating practice. I can't sit here and say that Dante Thornton was dominating any practices. He was good. He was better than advertised. Dominating? I wouldn't say that just yet. And that's not to take anything away from him. It's just to say that some of what's being put out there now about him is a little bit different than what we saw. I think he's way ahead of the curve. I think that the progress is there, but pump the brakes on all that. It's Vinny Bonsignore. It is JT The Brick Show. Give us a call, 702-365-9200. We're
back to the JT The Brick Show with your host for today, Vinny Bonsignore, only on Raider Nation Radio 920 AM.
I think he's versatile. He could play both inside and outside receiver. He's got experience doing both. You know, his ability in terms of catching the football, you know, his drop rate, I think, is zero. You know, he's just anything thrown in his direction, he seems to somehow come down on. I think he's got a really good understanding of coverage and schemes where he knows how to get himself open at the appropriate time. And that's part of it. You know, being a receiver is you have to be where you're supposed to be, when you're supposed to be there with separation and catch a football. And he can do all four of those things. So really the leader of that group. And we're young at the wideout spot. But, you know, for those guys to be able to rely on someone like Jacoby to kind of been there, done that, been in two organizations and was really good at both. And just really happy that we get a chance to work with him and, you know, have at least a veteran, him and Trey, out there at the wideout spot so I can help some of the young guys out there.
That's Raiders offensive coordinator Chip Kelly talking about the young wide receivers, what Jacoby Myers can mean to these young wide receivers. And, of course, we're talking about Jack Besh. We're talking about Dante Thornton. We're talking about Tommy Mellott and how they slot behind who appears to be, without question, the top two targets, you know, on the pecking order. And that's Jacoby Myers being number two and Brock Bowers being number one. How does it all filter out beyond them? And we got to always account for Ashton Jeanty being part of the passing game too. But Michael Mayer, you know, Trey Tucker, right? Dante Thornton, you know, Jack Besh. Who amongst those four are going to be that number three guy on that target list? Or is it going to be a hodgepodge of all four of those guys? Here to help us sort it out is our good friend Ryan Hoag, a former Raider, former NFL wide receiver, former Mr. Irrelevant, who's not irrelevant, anything but here with us. Ryan, how are you doing, my friend?
Well, I don't know about the not irrelevant because your producer just called me Rick. Is this Rick? So that's where we're at in life. But you know what? It's all good. I'm doing great, Vinny. Thanks for having me on.
You got it, Ryan. And before we get to football, am I reading this correct? Is there an American player, Taylor Fritz, in the semifinals of Wimbledon?
Can you believe it? I know. Fritz has been coming on and playing really, really good tennis lately. It's exciting. And, you know, he's got to obviously get through the couple big-time stars to win it, but he's probably our best chance in the last 15, 20 years to actually win Wimbledon.
But isn't – and really Ben Shelton is still alive, right?
Right, yeah. Ben Shelton, I mean, I think Fritz's game all around is a little more solid. You know, Ben Shelton's obviously a huge hitter. That's why he does well on grass. And obviously Shelton's going to play against Sinner, or if – we'll see if Sinner defaults or not because of his injury. But, yeah, we could have two in the semis. That's really, really exciting.
For those of you who don't know, as good of a football player as Ryan is, he's a fantastic tennis player. In fact, he teaches tennis. He's a tennis pro and an instructor in Southern California. What would that mean for American tennis if we could get, at the very least, two Americans in the semifinals in Wimbledon? That's been a long time since that happened.
Well, it's been a long time since we've had, you know, guys in the top five, right? Mm-hmm. And anytime you can garner that kind of interest, then you have younger generation wanting to be the Ben Sheltons of the world, to be the Taylor Fritzes of the world. And that's when you see our golden years of Jimmy Connors, John McEnroe, to Pete Sampras and Agassi, when we were kind of dominating mm-hmm. the game. And it started because, A, everybody wanted to play it. We had the most tennis courts of anywhere, right? They've taken all those tennis courts away and even recently taken all those because of pickleball. But yeah, those are the kind of things that, again, it's kind of like if the U.S. could win a World Cup, right, on their home soil. I mean, I don't think we have a chance, but wouldn't that be nice? And then you'd see maybe a golden age of soccer coming about. But yeah, anytime you can get on that national stage, especially at something as historic as Wimbledon, that's really going to put, you know, U.S. tennis on the map and get these guys playing, you know, at the age of three, like everybody in Spain is doing and other places.
Well, as somebody who grew up loving John McEnroe and loving the attitude and the swagger and the way he played and his style, everything, the entire package, I was a huge fan of John McEnroe. That would be fantastic if it could ever get back to that point, if Americans can really start being a force again in tennis. All right, let's pivot back to football, Ryan. You know the wide receiver position as well as anybody, having played it at the highest level. We're talking about what wide receivers, or really targets, because I got to throw Michael Mayer in there as well, what the pecking order is going to be in terms of those targets once you get past Brock Bowers and Jacoby Myers. They're the number one and number two. I would imagine that there's going to be well over 200 targets that go to both of those players combined. But there's probably about another 300 balls to throw, you know, in this game plan, in this Raider game plan. Who amongst the players that we've been talking about do you see emerging as that kind of decided number three guy.
Yeah, so first and foremost, I think that's why you saw a guy like Dante Thornton get so many reps in minicamp, because that's all that is an evaluation period. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't take the depth chart very seriously. You don't take, but the things I look at as a guy that lived through that and was cut and, you know, also, you know, made teams and I could see, you know, kind of how the pieces were falling is they're trying to evaluate, hey, is this a guy that if push came to shove, are we going to feel comfortable potentially putting him in there? Right. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's visions of grandeur of, you know, week one that he is going to be the starting Z receiver. I don't know that for a Pete Carroll that's saying, hey, we're in it to win now, that they would do that to a fourth round draft pick. And again, maybe he'll just, you know, surpass every expectation anybody has and he'll do it. But I think that's why you saw him get so many reps and even get sprinkled in with the ones is, hey, number one, we don't have a ton of wide receivers that have a lot of experience.
Right.
So why not just take a look at a guy that, and again, you led off the show with Chip Kelly talking about that clean slate and giving every guy a chance. And obviously, you know, he passes the eye test before you even put anything on. And then you put him in, you know, underwear, as people say, without pads, and probably looks really good. It was kind of like me. I was called the tempo violator back when I was playing for the Minnesota Vikings because I was a pro ball receiver in practice. Like I was the best, you know, I would take pride in putting Terrell Owens' jersey number on and playing that receiver. And I would do well, but you know, it didn't necessarily translate to me getting, you know, the ball when there was pads on and it was on Sunday and things like that. So people need to pause it a little bit. One thing I thought that was interesting, Vinny, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, is I usually look at, you know, where people are slotted and who they're behind when it comes to the depth chart.
Mm-hmm.
And when I see that Jack got put as the number two behind Jacoby, right, as the slot receiver, is that correct? Is that our official depth chart? Am I correct
well,
in saying that?
You know, based on what we saw, and like you said, and I'm right there with you, to whatever extent we can buy into what the depth chart looked like during OTA,
right.
I think the starters are the starters for sure. But behind yeah. them, I think there's some question. Whatever we could read into that, yes, that's what we would read into that, was that
he was the
number two slot wide receiver.
Yeah, so I remember any time I was like, you know, when I was playing for the Vikings and playing behind Moss, or, you know, I would know that, okay, even though I might have to understand all of the positions, when the team put me behind like a solidified starter, they were like, okay, we feel good about Ryan here, but we're not necessarily ever going to count on him to be a starter. We're going to think about special teams and we're going to think about the future with him. We're not thinking. And so my mind immediately went to, okay, Jack's not going to participate this year as a big time contributor on the offensive side of the football, maybe on special teams. But when you have your best receiver and you are, you know, what people think as one of the next in line, but they slot you behind that. And again, in Chip Kelly's offense and these West Coast like styled offenses, you have to absolutely know all the positions.
Mm-hmm.
But I look at it as a signal to me that Jack is going to be counted on to learn. If Jacoby goes down, we feel like you're a plug and play guy and we're going to have you focus on learning how to be a professional and learning how to be a him. We're not going to worry about splinting you in X and Z, although you may, but really we're going to focus on you playing there. And for me, that tells me Jack isn't going to be in the mix this season. Now, again, this is me extrapolating like very little information. You would know more. You saw, you know, practices. I did not until we're both at training camp, things like that. But that's what I see just looking at the depth chart from my point of view.
Yeah, I do. And we're talking to Ryan Hoag, former Raider wide receiver, former NFL wide receiver, including with the Minnesota Vikings. I actually think that as the season goes on, I think because my pick for that number three guy is a combination between a Michael Mayer and a Jack Besh. And I think that Jack Besh, I think he's going to give the Raiders a lot of compelling reasons to play him beyond just as Jacoby Myers' backup. Because what we did see when he was on the field was a lot of savvy, a lot of skill, just a really good football player. And I think that as the season goes on, his role is going to expand, and they're going to get him on the field because he's going to tell them, I need to be on the field, by his study habits, by his practice habits, and all that. So I actually see that playing out for, but I don't know. You know, who knows? That's I guess the beauty of it, is how will that change in training camp, and will he make a compelling enough case for them to say it's, you know, we're shortchanging him by just making him Jacoby's backup. We need to get him on the field elsewhere. How do you go about making that case for yourself?
Yeah, well, number one, the best ability is availability, and he's got to stay healthy. I remember, you know, and when I had never missed a single practice. I played 5 sports in high school, right? I played 4 sports in college, Vinny. I had never missed a single practice in any sport in my entire life until my 3rd day of mini camp with the Raiders and my 3rd day of training camp with the Raiders, both pulled in my hamstring. Right. And there, I lost my shot. Like there was, you know, a guy that came in running 4.3, right, ran the fastest 3-cone shuttle at the combine. It didn't matter. Like when you're playing, and I remember having a conversation with Rich Gannon because he was a fellow Minnesota guy. He liked me and he's coming off his MVP season. He's like, Ryan, he's like, it's hard enough in this league to be successful full speed, let alone when you're battling, you know. And I came back as early as I could because I'm getting pressured from the coaches and, you know, did we waste our draft pick in this and this and that? And then I'm coming back, I'm playing 80%. And, you know, for a guy that needs to pop and explode and only might get 3 reps in a practice, right? You better make sure you're running through that defense and taking the top off the coverage or whatever it might be. So I would say for Jack, for number one, he's got to make sure he stays healthy. And then, you know, you have to be able to play all 4 special teams units, right? And full stop. If you were going to be a number 4 or 5 receiver in the NFL, you have to be able to play, whether that's front line on kickoff return that nobody likes to do. It's one of the hardest things I ever had to do. Or as a kickoff returner, punt returner, you know, I started holding later in my career just because I was like, the more you can do so they can't find ways to get rid of you or to find a reason to put you on practice squad or whatever it is. Obviously, Jack, they probably won because they, you know, picked him so high. But, you know, those are the kind of things that Jack's going to. And it's hard as a rookie receiver, Vinny, even as a second or third year guy, because you're just trying to learn a brand new offense. You're trying to, you know, just fit in and make sure you're not making mental errors. Because, again, a guy, old school coach like Pete Carroll, if you make mental errors, you're going to find your butt on the bench. A veteran quarterback like Geno Smith, you know, he wants to know exactly where you're going to be and has an expectation. If you cause an interception because you ran 12 yards instead of 14 yards on that dig route, that's on that. That makes it look like it's on him, and that's money out of his pocket. And he's going to be like, get him out of the game. I need to find guys that are going to do their job.
We're talking to Ryan Hoag, former Raider, former Minnesota Viking, tennis expert, aficionado, also an excellent coach. An instructor in terms of tennis. You know, we were talking about, real quick, Tommy Mellott, the rookie from Montana State, a college quarterback, much like Julian Edelman at Kent State, and is now making the transition to wide receiver with the Raiders. I think special teams is going to be his calling card early on. But as he's making that transition from quarterback to wide receiver, it's hard enough making any, you know, the jump from college to the NFL. But throw a little bit of caveat there. He's switching his positions. What's the if you were to sit down with Tommy in terms of learning to play now wide receiver at this level, what would you say for him? What would you tell him to focus on first and foremost as he's starting to build himself as an NFL wide receiver?
Well, it's fun being out here. You know, Vinny, I am coaching tennis out here in Montana, and everybody asks me about Tommy anytime they find out I have a Raiders affiliation. Hey, you got our guy. They are so excited about Tommy Mellott and his future. You know, I would say the one advantage I would say coming from his position is because he already read a defense looks at an offense in a conceptual way, meaning, hey, we have this 5 route concept, and here's how we're trying to attack against a cover 3 or a quarters coverage or a quarter half, whatever defense they're playing. And as a quarterback, you know, even though he was a run pass quarterback, right, you still, from a fundamental state growing up, right, you're taught to learn, here are route concepts and here are cover 2 beaters and here's why we're doing it and these are 3-level attack and this and that. As a wide receiver, right? We don't often learn that, right? Dante Thornton might never have heard. He might just be like, you know what? Hey, we got 471. The 7 is talking to me. I got this route, you know, or a 8 route, 88, double post concept. I just need to beat that guy in front of me, and I'm going to go out-athlete him. And again, I'm not taking anything away from Dante. I don't know. But oftentimes when you're 6'5 and run 4'3, you can just out-athlete people, and the coaches are going to know that. And to your point, Tennessee ran a really unique offense, I think, under Josh Heupel or whatever, whoever's offense that is, and they're just going to set guys up for success and go do it. Whereas Tommy is coming from that quarterback position where he looks at a defense a lot differently than I came out of college looking at a defense. And so he's going to be able to manipulate and understand, like, especially if they put him in the slot and allow him to just kind of be a roamer and do kind of like Travis Kelce type things where he's, and I'm not saying he's Travis Kelce,
right,
but Travis Kelce manipulates zone defenses so well and is so in tune with the quarterback. And Tommy will have an opportunity to be like, okay, if I was playing quarterback, here's where I would want to attack this, you know, flat defender that's widened out a little too far, and I'm going to hook up here on an option route or whatever it is. And hopefully they're putting him in those situations to succeed, as opposed to just being like a straight line. Hey, you got to run a 12-yard curl. You're only going to play outside, because that just doesn't feel – to me, Phil, his skill set, and I want to see him doing more of kind of the, you know, manipulating the defense, zone beaters. And so I would tell him to focus on, you know, reading defenses and understanding how to beat zone coverage. And if you can do that, you're going to be a step ahead of anybody. And then also, obviously, learning all the receiver positions.
Right. Ryan, I could talk football with you all day long. Thank you so much. Enjoy the nice.
One more thing for you, Vinny.
Go
I know
for
you
it.
Have to go. But do you know how many catches the running backs had for Chip Kelly at Ohio State last year?
I would say it was close to 100.
166.
Whoa.
So your question of who's going to be that number three, I would say a running back position. I love the idea of playing 21 personnel or 22 personnel, given what we have as a roster right now. I still think we're going to add a receiver from free agency, but if we don't, look for a lot of 21, 22, and putting our running backs out in space and catching a lot of passes.
Can't wait to talk about it to you further in training camp. Stand on the sidelines and watch it with you and learn from you. Thank you so much, Ryan, and hopefully next time we talk, there'll be an American in the finals at Wimbledon. Truly appreciate it, my brother.
Thanks, Vinny. Yep, see ya.
You got it. That was Ryan Hoag, former NFL wide receiver. It is Vinny Bonsignore. It's the JT the Brick Show, 702-365-9200.
To the JT the Brick Show with your host for today, Vinny Bonsignore, on Raider Nation Radio 920 AM.
Today we really played game like, you know, we started, it was 10 minutes left in the third quarter. And so we played all the way through to the end of the game. And somehow the commissioner got it to come down to a tie, which was great. And then because we wanted to go into OT, and we went into OT and had a couple exchanges in overtime as well. So we just tried to log as many situations as we could throughout all of our time together. The last time we tried to go OT, we had a lightning thing that we had to get off the field on. So I kind of overdid it. We had like almost, you know, everybody got a couple shots in OT legitimately as the clock worked. And so worked out great.
That's Pete Carroll. Want to say thanks to Ryan Hoag and Rich Orenberger for shedding light on their observations of the Raiders, and obviously in Rich's case, the Chargers and what they're doing down there in Los Angeles. So funny to listen to Pete Carroll talking about taking advantage, as many advantages to get better as possible, including pushing that last minicamp practice to overtime. I'll never forget the work stoppage a few years ago when he was with Seattle Seahawks coach, and there was this injunction, a court-ordered injunction, where players could get back in the building real quick. This was during, you know, the offseason. And it lasted all of 3 hours or so. But in that time, he was able to get the players into the building and do some 11-on-11, some 7-on-7. So he took advantage of the three-hour window where the players could get back to work to try to get better. It's a staple of Pete Carroll. So, again, our thanks to Rich Orenberger, our thanks to our listeners, our thanks to Ryan Hoag, always shedding some great light. We'll be back at it tomorrow, 12 to 2 p.m., and right after I get off, it's, of course, Q Myers and Unsportsmanlike Conduct. Keep everything locked in on Raider Nation Radio.